The life of a double bass player isn't easy. Number one, you have to cart that instrument around most of your life from the time you're about, probably 8 or 9 years old and start playing it. And there's just not a whole lot in the repertoire for the instrument, nor are there a lot of virtuosos around because they don't have the opportunity. Most double bass players making their living teaching and probably in chamber orchestras and symphony orchestras. But every now and then, you do get the solo career like Edgar Meyer has had for ages. And there he was playing with the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, along with Hugh Wolf, the double bass concerto by Giovanni Battistini. And Edgar Meyer also often appears and records with his friends Mark O'Connor and Yo-Yo Ma, doing some wonderful stuff. Looking through this date in history, it was on this date in 1846 that New York and Boston were first linked by telegraph wires, talking to each other. In 1893, now that's not a familiar date, the New York stock market crashed as well. And some birthdays being celebrated today. Ross Perot is 79 years old, and singer-musician Bruce Johnston of the Beach Boys is 67. Actress Julia Duffy is 58. So happy birthday to them and to you if it's your birthday today.
Beautiful classical programming here on WHFR Dearborn, WHFR Radio. We thank you for listening. Hope you're enjoying the programming as always. And thanks very much for your pledge of support during our recent on-air radio pledge drive called Radiothon 2009. Yes, the official on-air pledge pitching has ended, but we want to say a special thanks to those of you who have taken the time to call in or write in or go online and pledge your financial support, your tax-deductible contribution to our radio station to allow us to continue presenting beautiful programming like this. If you missed Radiothon for some reason or you didn't have an opportunity to call in or go online and pledge, there is certainly still time. Give me a call anytime, 313-845-9842. That's 313-845-9842. Susan McGraw here, and I will happily take your pledge of support. So thanks to those of you who've already done it, and thanks in advance to those of you who might still.
You are listening to WHFR Dearborn 89.3 on your FM dial.
Good morning. You are listening to Then and Now, presented on WHFR Dearborn from 10 to 11 a.m. and the fourth Saturday of every month as a part of the WHFR Forum, our weekly talk show format. Then and Now is a pre-recorded program on WHFR at 89.3 FM, Making Waves, that primarily deals with how history affects current events. And now to our host, Ned Apigian, with today's program. Ned?
Thank you, Melissa. I should say good morning. I got to turn my mic on first, right? Mm-hmm. Good morning and welcome to this week's program. And our special guest is Mr. Keith Wattenpaugh. And Keith, thank you for being our guest.
Sure.
And in order for you people to appreciate Keith, you got to know something about him. And this is his background. But before we go into his background, I'm going to give you a little bit of an idea of what we're going to talk about this week. And we are going to talk just about what we talk about most of the time. The unresolved issues of World War I is primarily the problem of many of the issues we're confronted with today. And Keith is very much an expert on all these things, and I'm going to tell you why. So get a piece of paper and pencil in case you want to mark this down. Professor Wattenpaugh is a historian and associate professor of modern Islam, human rights, and peace in the religious studies program at the University of California, Davis. Keith Wattenpaugh has completed a book, that will bring the Middle East into larger history of human events. His book will shed light on how the international community has conceptualized minority-majority relationships in Muslim societies and sectarian and ethnic differences in the Arab world. It will focus on the multiple and sectarian ethnic differences in the Arab world. It would focus on, I read the wrong line there, Keith, I'm sorry. Okay. Intersections of the modern international human rights regimes, genocide, Islam in the 20th century in the Middle East. Professor Watanpah was trained at UCLA, has lived and conducted research in Egypt, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Turkey, and Iraq. He conducted research in Iraq both before and after the 2003 U.S.-led invasion and occupation. In June 2003, he traveled to Iraq to lead the first independent assessment of Baghdad's libraries, research centers, and universities. His team's effort took the form of the widely used report, Opening the Doors, Intellectual Life and Academic Conditions in Post-War Baghdad. He served on the Middle East Studies Association's Committee on Academic Freedom in the Middle East and North Africa, and has worked with the scholars at RUSC program on behalf of Iraqi academic refugees, as well as the University of California Initiative on Human Rights. Mr. Professor Watanpah received a B.A. in History and Near Eastern Languages and Culture from the University of Washington, Seattle, and an M.A. and Ph.D. in History from UCLA. Mr. Watanpah is fluent in Arabic, Turkish, and Armenian, his last language. As you can see, he is an expert on many topics that have to do with the Middle East, and many of the issues that are unresolved during the First World War, of course, find themselves in the Middle East. Keith, welcome.
Thank you, Ned. I should also mention that I'm currently a senior fellow in international peace at the United States Institute of Peace in Washington, D.C.
That's right.
Where I'm talking to you from now.
That's right. I forgot to mention that because sure. It's not on your standard biography
that I
took off the computer. Our program today is going to be devoted to the three peace treaties that ended the First World War, and you will see the things that they didn't address are the things they created in the peace treaty, which eventually came to the League of Nations, and then what the League of Nations was supposed to do. He'll tell us about that, what it didn't do, what it couldn't do, and what it should have done. So those are the four things we'll be getting into. But in order to get into the League of Nations, you got to know something about the peace treaties that ended the First World War. The first one, I guess in order, would be the Peace Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, which the Germans signed with the Russians to knock them out of the war, if that has some bearing on the issues of the UN. I mean, not the League of Nations, not the UN. Then the Versailles Treaty, and then the Treaty of Mudros that the Allies signed with Turkey, then an ally of Germany. Keith, begin at your leisure.
Well, probably the Treaty of Versailles is the most important one in terms of establishing the League of Nations. It's the one that first set down the idea that, you know, the war had been so terrible, there had been so many casualties, it had sort of rocked the entire world in a way that was unprecedented, that the winners of the war, the Allied victors of the war, wanted to figure out a way to prevent it war happening again. And really the major impetus for that part of the war was Woodrow Wilson, who was the American president, who brought the United States into the war on the basis of a new ideology. He believed that the war was supposed to be about something, not just about power or victory in the field, but that this was a war that was going to be fought so that war wouldn't be fought again. And I think it's easy to dismiss him as a naive idealist, but I think they're very, very persuasive ideas, and The United States had tremendous international prestige at the time. The European states that had fought the war were so utterly devastated by it, and they looked to the United States for leadership. And so the League of Nations really emerged out of that. And I think that at the beginning, I mean, when we look at the League of Nations we think of it in terms of an utter failure. We can go into reasons for that then. But it's important to understand that at the time of when it was first proposed and then first established, that there was a great deal of enthusiasm and a great deal of hope that surrounded its founding. And I think that tells you how desperate people were at the time to avoid a new kind of conflict. But the basic idea of the League was that, you know, if you have international conflict, you should try to work it out through diplomacy and negotiation, and that an international body like the League would take the lead in formulating collective security. In other words, defending democracies or defending the international community against bad actors. So that's the basic beginnings of the League itself, and then it began to adopt different functions and expand into different fields through the course of the 1920s and 1930s.
In the peace treaty of Versailles, were there definite that Wilson was able to put that there will be a League of Nations?
Oh, yeah, right. League of Nations.
What are certain articles? And
right, exactly. The League, that's where it starts.
I see.
Yeah. It was unclear where it was going to be, but they eventually moved it to Geneva. The idea being that Switzerland was neutral, and plus there already were other international bodies hosted in Geneva at that point. You know. And there was a nice hotel. They named the main hotel or one of the big hotels in Geneva after President Wilson.
Is it still named the Wilson Hotel?
Yeah, there's the Hotel Wilson in Geneva still.
The mandates that the Peace Treaty of Versailles talked about, they were in the Peace Treaty of Versailles?
The mandates were the idea of the mandates occurs later. And that's in a series of other arrangements and treaties. But the mandates were the mandates themselves, and we can talk about that in a second, but let me just explain that, were established in Article 22 of the Covenant of the League of Nations.
I see.
So the Covenant of the League of Nations, like the Constitution of the League of Nations, and the mandate system was a kind of a cocktail of different ideas that applied to what to do with former colonies of Germany and also what to do with residual parts of the Ottoman Empire. And the idea was that in the new world of the after the First World War, there wasn't going to be colonialism anymore. But on the other hand, there was a lot of pressure from Britain and France to sort of, they had agreed before or during the war to divide up parts of the old Ottoman Empire amongst themselves. And so the compromise was that they would create a mandate system. And the basic underpinning idea of the mandates was that Western powers, France and Britain in this case, would occupy territory, but that occupation would be temporary.
I see.
And as a temporary occupation, the reason why the French and the British were involved was to help these countries become independent. The idea being that they were on a lower level of civilization, that the French and the British would raise their level of civility.
Perhaps we ought to explain. The audience may not all know what mandates are. That's the reason why the French and the British had a lot to say about what happened in the Middle East, how Lebanon was created in a French mandate, in Syria, and then
Iraq, Iraq, Palestine, and Transjordan were under the British.
And you ought to explain about, because in other words, they carved up these things and created these countries, you know, bringing the princes of Mecca and making them kings. You might want to talk about
that. Well, that's what's interesting. I mean, the Ottoman Empire had ruled sort of these majority Arab lands for 500 years. And as the British and the French conquered this territory in the First World War, they occupied portions of it on the basis of a treaty that they had, secret treaty they had signed during the war. It's known as the Sykes-Picot, right. In Iraq, recently, because of the Iraq War, there's been a lot of discussion about this, especially this idea that Iraq is an artificial state, which is created out of the three Ottoman provinces of Mosul, Baghdad, and Basra. And in many ways, that's true, that the French and the British drew lines on maps according to their own political interests, not necessarily reflecting any lived reality on the ground.
What was the need to create Transjordan?
Well, Transjordan, I think, and not to be too glib about it, was pretty much what was left over between Iraq and Palestine. In fact, its original name, Transjordan, means the other side of the Jordan River. It wasn't named for what it was.
In Arabic? In Arabic, is that where?
Well, no. No, Transjordan was a British formulation.
Yes.
But it was an area
Churchill,
that was
Lawrence of Arabia, and what was that woman's name, Margaret?
Gertrude Bell.
Gertrude Bell. If only people knew about those things. And now you wonder why there's unrest, these people that live in these circumstances. What, you want to say something about the Balfour thing that affected the...
Well, that was one of the other World War I era agreements, which has had an important impact on the region, on the Middle East, which is that during the war, the British Parliament declared that it was in favor of the establishment of a national home for Jews in Palestine. The decision was taken at a time when Palestine was still in Ottoman hands, but nevertheless, after the war, this was British policy. And this contradicted both their agreement with the French in Sykes-Picot, their agreements they had made with their Arab allies, and also violated certain conditions that the British agreed to when they decided to set up the mandate system.
Well, so. I did not know that it violated agreement. I could understand it violated the agreements that Lawrence of Arabia made with the Arabs, but I didn't know it violated the agreements you said between the French.
Yeah, I mean, Sykes-Picot was about dividing British spheres of influence, and included sort of international ideas about Jerusalem and so on. But there certainly wasn't anything in Sykes-Picot that necessarily precluded the British from setting up a homeland for the Jews in Palestine, but it certainly wasn't part of the original deal.
And those people in our audience that remember seeing Lawrence of Arabia and this whole thing was discussed, what was the actor's name, the American actor who played the role of Sykes? His name I can't remember, but it's all spelled out there. And you're wondering what the problems are today. Certain people promise different things to different people.
Right. You're thinking of Claude Rains.
Claude Rains, that's him. He was the sinister...
sort of diplomat.
Diplomat that told Lawrence of Arabia, now that you've created your little revolution, we're going to divide this thing up the way we want, and whatever promises you made to them while you were riding a camel is not worth much. Let me take a minute now to do a station identification because this information is so interesting. You are listening to Then and Now. This is a pre-recorded program, and you cannot call in. However, we are podcasted on the internet. You can re-listen to this program and other programs by going to our website. Type in your search whfr.fm. Click on the forum button and select any fourth Friday of the month or today's date, May 22nd, and you can rehear us. And this is WHFR.FM, making waves right here from the Henry Ford Community College campus, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week in Dearborn, Michigan. And we hope you're enjoying this program. Keith, would you take it to the next level with the Treaty of Mudros? Is that of some interest?
Well, I think that the more important treaties in the Middle East that I think have had an influence on the outcome, Mudros, of course, ends the war.
And that's all it does.
Right. In many ways, and it the Ottoman government surrenders. Then there's a series of follow-up treaties that are under the rubric of the League, but also primarily the Allies.
Well, there was no league then.
Not yet. But the most important first treaty was the Treaty of Sèvres.
Sev, right.
Right? Now, Sev is one that's very important and still contemporary groups in the Middle East and abroad make claims on the basis of Sev. This
you mean other than Armenians? Other, and
Kurds
do, too.
And Assyrians and even Arabs to some extent.
But the Sev Treaty was never adopted by anyone.
Well, Sev Treaty was negotiated and adopted by the Western allies, but it was never accepted by Turkey.
That happen?
Well, they just said no. They negotiated, and then in the meanwhile, the Ottoman state really disappears and is replaced by a nationalist government.
Oh, so during this period, they were trying to effectuate that Kemal Atatürk's nationalist movement took control of the government.
Right, exactly. I mean, the thing is that the Allies were negotiating the Treaty of Sev with the losers.
Right.
And they
the
weren't,
loser
they,
said no.
The losers just negotiated. There were problems. But, you know, the Treaty of Sev was never put into effect because the Kemalist government, the government of Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, who rebelled against the treaty and established the modern Republic of Turkey, rejected the terms of the Treaty of Sev.
So it's not important that the United States was not a signatory. Was it supposed to be?
Well,
because we were the United States didn't declare war against
no,
Turkey.
No, the United States was, I think, an interested party in the Treaty of Sev, especially because American support for Armenians was very powerful that time. But, you know, the United States never declared war on Turkey, and very quickly, the United States support for international institutions and the League of Nations itself evaporated very quickly. I mean, this is one of the greatest ironies of history, is that there would have been no League of Nations without Woodrow Wilson, but the United States Senate never approved the Treaty of Versailles League of Nations components, and so the United States never became a part of the League of Nations.
So did the United States become therefore not a signatory to the Versailles Peace Treaty?
I think we signed parts of it, but
you could do that? That was it. I never thought of that until you just mentioned it.
I mean, the thing is, the president can sign treaties, but then the Senate has to ratify.
And right.
The Senate can put in reservations of treaties or ratify. I need to look that one up. But you know, we signed the Treaty of Versailles. There's a famous painting, in fact, of Woodrow Wilson signing it. But the Senate, Bora, the senator from Idaho, and Henry Cabot Lodge, Massachusetts, right? They were not necessarily isolationists, but they believed that this was an unnecessary involvement in international affairs.
Was it because the United States was supposed to have the mandate over Armenia?
Of all the things that the United States was asked to do in the Treaty of Versailles or in the League of Nations, the one thing that had a remote possibility of happening was the American mandate on Armenia.
Was there any other responsibilities?
We would have been part of the League of Nations and have to involve ourselves in that, but the American mandate for Armenia was not unpopular.
Right.
In fact, it was fairly popular. It was popular to some extent. I mean, it was irrelevant because the Soviets took over. It wasn't like we were going to fight a war with Russia. It was one of the few things that I think, in retrospect, that the Americans really believed in, because there had been so much American support for Armenians during and after the genocide.
I'm sure this was primarily a Republican scheme not to adopt the...
But there were also Democrats and others, too.
Okay.
Yeah. I think you have to understand it more that the United States had never really been involved in world politics. And Woodrow Wilson was kind of dragging America kicking and screaming into the world affairs. Right? And that... At that point, the natural American inclination was to say, look, that's Europe. That's their problems. You know,
right.
we sacrificed our boys in this war, and what do we get from it? Nothing.
Right.
And we're not going to be part of this. I think that in many ways, there were people on the left, like Wilson, and then later Franklin Roosevelt, who I think had a much different sense of America's role in the world. And so there's been a real change, in fact, of of the American presence.
So the peace treaty of Mudros ending, when a lot of people may not understand, the Ottoman Empire really is the Turkish Ottoman Empire, of where the Turks, a relative minority, who were in militaristic command of the Middle East, ruled over Arabs and all sorts of people, Greeks, Bulgarians, Macedonians, Armenians, Syrians, you name it, they were, but they were physically, numerically a minority.
Well, in Anatolia, Muslim Turks were probably about 60% of the total population.
Yes.
The more important issue is that these treaties failed. The Treaty of Sèvres failed. The Treaty of Sèvres had in it the establishment of both an Armenian state and a Kurdish state.
That's an interesting thing, because when we talk about this program and this issue of a Kurdish state, how is a Kurdish state in the Anatolia, isn't it?
Woodrow Wilson had sort of opined in a series of maps where a Kurdish state and where an Armenian state should be.
Well, I saw the Armenian state.
That one's pretty, but where the Kurds were was always a little bit more problematic, and made much more so by the early discovery of oil in Kirkuk in Iraq. So
they would give the peace treaty, would give that part of the Iraq to the Kurds?
Right, and that just wasn't going to happen.
Okay.
So the more important treaty to study is the Treaty of Lausanne, which is the final treaty.
The Peace Treaty of Lausanne, which was adopted by the then new Turkish state and the Western allies.
Right. And the thing about the Treaty of Lausanne, and then right almost immediately afterwards, Turkey joins the League of Nations and becomes a member of the international community. So it went from a real pariah state before the Treaty of Lausanne to a full-fledged member of the international community shortly thereafter. I think because Britain and France understood or wanted to cultivate Turkey as an ally, especially with competition.
And the Bolshevik Revolution helped them do that in
exactly.
1917. And how
right.
Was there any peace treaties with the Turkish state and the Soviet Union at the time?
Well, there was the Treaty of Alexandrinople, which was the treaty between the Armenian state and Turkey. And then there's a later treaty, the name I just...
Kars, was it?
No, it's after... Kars was one of the first ones. Then there's Alexandrinople, Gumri.
Uh-huh.
And then there's one other one later. But the border between Turkey and Armenia and sort of the Soviet Armenia, Soviet and Soviet Georgia, and part of Azerbaijan became pretty much fixed in 1922.
And based on what? A treaty?
A Treaty of Moscow is one of the treaties, and then I can't remember the other one.
So but it there, wasn't it, determined. That line that exists today, I thought, was part of the Brest-Litovsk division.
No, because the thing is that certain Soviets were, I mean, that there was the, you know, the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk brings Turkey closer to
the
borders of Azerbaijan than anything else. And just because as the Ottoman forces lost, there was the establishment of the Caucasian republics and so on, that changed the border somewhat in there. But the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, for example, determined the eastern border of Poland, of Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia.
Did that ever get respected anywhere today?
Well, I mean, the Soviet Union took... Poland shrank during and after the Second World War.
Right.
Much of what the Soviet Union took back during the Second World War and in the treaties afterwards was recovering some of the territory lost in the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk.
That's interesting. I was watching a program about that the other day on television about how during the Second World War, which we're not talking about now, how the British forced the Poles to give up a great part of their eastern part of Poland and gave them parts of Germany in the west. Mm-hmm. And most of the free Poles fighting came from that section they gave to the Soviet Union.
Right.
I hadn't realized that there was a, you know, because Germany before the war, the Second World War was, you know, Danzig and all that was further east than it is today.
Right. So that's, you know, so I think the important thing though is that the Treaty of Lausanne really changed in the Middle East some of the important social and cultural engineering that had been anticipated by the at the time of the formation of the League of Nations.
Especially
in terms of creating a viable large Armenian state and a viable Kurdish state or entity or something like this. And what's whereas Armenians ceased to be an important component of the politics of the Middle East, were absorbed politically into Lebanon and Syria and into the Soviet Republic of Armenia, Kurds and Kurdish aspirations
fell in Turkey.
Well, but they continued to be a problem for Turkey, Iraq, and Syria. And so if you want to really find a legacy of a
our problems today, I mean, you might want to delve into that.
Right, so that the Kurdish issue is one of the most important sort of failed legacies of failure from those early treaties, of, you know, in not addressing the national aspiration of the Kurds, I think was a major failure.
What's the reason for that? They have
they have no influence.
They have no written language. They have more.
I think they have all of the diaspora above. You know, it's they were unsuccessful in creating a real political unity that could.
How about
they're very divided amongst themselves.
How about a culture, as people understand?
Well, I think Kurds probably constitute as good a culture or as much a culture as just about any group. I mean, there's several different.
Since they're Muslims, how different are they from the rest of the Muslims?
This is very
culturally?
Interesting. Is that when during the night, one of the important innovations of the League of Nations was this creation of the minority commissions, and this idea that alongside national rights or the rights of majorities.
Mm-hmm.
Their minorities also had rights.
You know, that's interesting. You can hold that thought. I went to a seminar of where representatives of the Jewish community and the Turkish community in Michigan were getting together in promoting a love fest between the two of them, would be the best way to put it. And the representative from Turkey, who was obviously a leader of the Jewish community, stood up. And I found it interesting and talked about the rights that they had secured due to the peace treaty of Lausanne. And I don't know how many other people appreciated that, but I knew what he was talking about. And
I mean, the problem was that Turkey did agree to minority protections in the Treaty of Lausanne.
And never followed.
But never followed through. And it's ironic that Turkey in the 1930s treated its Jewish minority
just
terribly.
Right.
So, that in many ways, an alleged love fest between contemporary Turks and contemporary American Jews or Israelis is based more on the strategic relationship between contemporary Turkey and Israel.
Well, in fact, I didn't get a chance to ask my question that day, and I had arranged to have several of the Armenian professors and actually Turkish professors at U of M to come to that conference, and hopefully they'd ask an embarrassing question that really had nothing to do with the Armenian question, had to do, and they didn't get a chance to speak, but I was going to ask them a question like, did the Varlik Verksi taxes of 1940-42, did they affect the Jews as well as the Christians?
Right.
And then he was a former ambassador, he could have stumbled his way through that with the Jews in the audience. And then the next question I was going to ask him was the 1955 September riots, when they were rampaging, destroying mostly Greek and Christian institutions of business, did they happen to also attack the Jewish-owned businesses in Istanbul? And my friends that went there, they insisted on standing up and talking about the Armenian issue, which, of course, wouldn't divide the two groups between anything. And I asked them, I wish they would not have done that. But in any event,
The Treaty of Lausanne, the most important things about it, though, is it established ultimately created a modus vivendi for Turkish, Franco-British relationships within the Middle East, and it did leave out minorities in many ways. The large portions of Armenians who were still in Anatolia in 1922, by 1925, almost all had left. So there wasn't the Turkey's commitment to upholding the minority clauses in the Treaty of Lausanne, which is, you know, wasn't even worth the piece of paper that it was written on.
How close were those minority clauses related to the so-called commissions that were forced upon Turkey prior to the First World War that the Western powers put on them? What did you call those?
Well, I think they were...
What is that commission called?
Well, there are a series of capitulations that they were supposed to make, and also you had foreign intervention on behalf of various minorities in the Ottoman Empire. But, I mean, the important thing is that the minority, in the Treaty of Lausanne, the minority clauses were very similar to what the League of Nations was promoting at that point, which is that minorities have rights alongside the majorities, and that one of the reasons for the existence of the League of Nations is to protect the rights of minorities.
Well, this is a good place to take a break. We're a little bit at halfway over, about 32 minutes, and it's time to take our station identification. And I'd like to inform our listeners who they're listening to. Number one, I am your host, Ned Apigian, your monthly host on the fourth Saturday of the month. And our guest today is Professor Keith Wattenpaugh, an associate professor of history at the University of California at Davis, so that you realize who you're talking to. And this is the other important thing. You can hear us on the internet at 89.3.fm. And the important thing about that is if you enjoyed what you're listening to, you go into and search WHFR.fm, click on the forum programs on the button, and then you'll get dates. And if you want to hear this program again, you just click on May 22nd. I think that's what today is. And you will hear this program again. If you want to hear any of the former programs that I have done, mostly about the same things, they're historically oriented and dealing with people with the background similar to, if not identical to, Professor Wattenpaugh. Now, I think I've
told... So we're talking about the minority commissions and the minority...
Right.
Clauses. I think that's this is one of the interesting historical questions about the League of Nations, which is, you know, where did this impulse to try to protect minorities come from? Was it of any use? You know, was it a good thing to do? And, you know, what was the League of Nations able to really protect minorities in the end?
Why don't you tell us something about the Balkans? Because, you know, what happened after the war, we created Yugoslavia, These unsettled things. Which one of these from the League of Nations, the creation, the peace treaty of Versailles, in taking the former Serbia and joining Croatians, and what are the unfulfilled promises there that have created the havoc we still see today?
Now, well, in many ways, you have the creation of the Kingdom of Serbs, Croats, and Slovenes, which is Yugoslavia, which just means Southern Slavia. And
Southern Slavs.
Right. And when Woodrow Wilson, for example, was thinking about the rights of minorities and national self-determination, many of the ideas we've come to associate with the principles of Wilsonianism, he pretty much had in mind the Slavs. And the various linguistic minorities of the former Austro-Hungarian Empire.
Mm.
So after the First World War, of course, one of the major things that happened is the breakup of Austria-Hungary and the separation of some of its various holdings into separate states. So this would include the modern states of Austria, which is much smaller than it used to be as part of Austria-Hungary, which lost portions of its territory to create Czechoslovakia, which is now the Czech Republic and the Slovak Republic, and then also portions of Yugoslavia, which is now broken up into several other states, which was also cobbled together out of territory that was lost to, say, Serbia, or lost from the Ottoman Empire to Serbia in the series of small wars that occurred just before the First World War.
Right.
So, I mean, it's in that situation...
Aren't these people pretty much ethnically the same? That's having the Armenians be Muslim, the other ones be Catholic, and the other ones be Orthodox.
Right, I think there's a lot of religious difference. But there's also, it's one of the problems of the interwar period where there's dividing people up on the basis of sort of imagination or ethnicity rather than taking into account viable states or old trade ties were very difficult. And I think it begs the question whether or not, you know, is it really the best thing to have, you know, a nation with one ethnicity? Is that really the best thing? Or, you know, is there a possibility that you can have multiple ethnicities in one nation? I mean, is it possible to have a multi-ethnic state, not necessarily a multi-ethnic empire?
What do you think were the problems? Why are we having, do you think it was wrong to,
Yugoslavia? I don't think you can really trace a lot of the problems of contemporary Yugoslavia in the Balkans and the Bosnian War, and the Kosovo War. These things have a lot more to do with sort of arrogant, contemporary, ambitious nationalist politicians, often using and abusing history for their own purposes, but really can be traced to decisions they've made to inflame nationalist hatreds and so on that either had sort of been forgotten or weren't that important to people. And so I think it's very hard, in my mind, to necessarily sort of trace back the recent Balkan conflicts to unresolved issues from the First World War, as much as it is to lay blame at the hands of people like Slobodan Milosevic, who was politically ambitious and used ultra-nationalism to his personal advantage.
Well, let me ask you one thing. What's the difference between the Czechs and the Slovaks that they so peacefully divided themselves into two teeny weeny countries?
Are they
ethnically the same? Are they religiously different? What?
Well, I don't want to make... Sometimes the differences between people are more acute to them than they are to people looking at them from the outside.
So it was a good thing.
I don't know. I mean, the Czechs, I think have done better than the Slovaks. I mean, the Czech part or Bohemia was much more developed.
Maybe it was in the beginning, and its potential was always better.
Right, and so I think that but a lot of this has to do with local politicians wanting to have more local control. And I think also there's this, Europe is a place where, because of supranational institutions like the European Union, small states can sometimes benefit by being small, and big states often bear more of a burden because they're big. So, and since tariff and trade barriers are pretty much reduced, these small states can compete on an equal playing field with larger states. So there's no real, you could see, for example, Spain having more autonomous zones than it does now. You could see this happening, not necessarily in France, but certainly in Great Britain.
The Bosnia and Herzegovina are just districts the Austro-Hungarian Empire divided among themselves.
Right.
But those people are all the same. They're just Muslims that are the same tall, blue-eyed basketball players that are Croatian, right?
Bosniaks tend to be, speak the same language, eat the same food, and physically resemble their Serbian and Croatian neighbors. But
yeah,
my point. You can't undervalue the role of war and memories of war in the creation of sort of a new identity. You know, these were people who kind of had an identity forced on them by being victims of attempted genocide. So, you know, that's you know, in many ways you could say, well, Bosnians are similar ethnically to their neighbors. And that's true.
Isn't there in Roman time they called all the people in that part of the world Illyrians or something?
Or Dalmatians.
Dalmatians.
Yeah. I don't know if they had spots or anything.
I think ethnically the Romanians are different. Their language is completely different.
Well, Romanian is an Indo-European language. I mean, is a Romance language.
Right.
So
I've heard that.
Yeah.
But these other people that speak Serbo-Croatian, I mean, they virtually speak the same language.
Right. It's the same language. It's just rendered in different alphabet, depending if you're in the Catholic part or the Orthodox part of the region.
And if you know that, you pretty well can understand Polish and know Russian, too.
Perhaps, yeah.
I understand. That would make the Humshin Armenians that are now Muslims in Anatolia that the Turks either forcibly converted to Islam, Armenians. I know that I had a meeting with the Armenian Pope, the Gatoligos, and he regarded his Muslim Armenians, excuse me, as his brethren.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was interesting.
Sure is. I mean, that's an interesting question, right? You know, can you be an Armenian without necessarily being a Christian? I mean, you can be an atheist and be an Armenian.
You can be agnostic and be an Armenian too. So,
right.
I would take him. There's not there aren't enough of us.
Right.
So why
can't be too choosy.
Yeah.
Right.
So now that we've reached the point, I want to have another station ID. We're getting close to the three-quarter point of our program, and we have to let our people know who they're talking to. You are listening to 89.3 FM, the college radio station, broadcasting 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, from the college campus in Dearborn, Michigan, and we're here making big radio waves. You are listening to Then and Now, a monthly forum talk show program based on how history affects current events. This is a pre-recorded program. You cannot call in. However, we are podcasted on the internet. You can re-listen to this and other programs by going to your website, type into your search category WHFR.FM, then click on the forum button, and select any fourth Friday of the month, or today's date, May 22nd, and you can rehear this program. And
yes,
I am.
It'll be the 23rd. It'll be played.
Oh,
tomorrow.
That's right, Jade. I'm getting my days mixed up.
Well, it'll be the 23rd for today's recording.
Right. So you click on the fourth Friday or the 23rd. I got my days wrong. I am Ned Apigian, your host, and our guest this week is Professor Keith Wattenpah, an associate professor of history at the University of California, Davis, and I hope you have enjoyed all his insight into the issues of the League of Nations and the peace treaties ending World War I, primarily the Peace Treaty of Versailles, that give us some insight into some of our problems that we have. Keith, is there any other way you want to take this conversation so that people can be enlightened as to these issues and how they affect current events?
Well, I think that one of the...
And you were listening, Jay Koronek, our station advisor. He's the primary major pro here. Without him, I couldn't do anything. I don't know.
No.
I wouldn't know what switch and what dial to hit every time I hit the wrong one.
Back to Keith.
Anyway.
Well, I think that
Keith.
One of the things I've been thinking about or working on lately is aspects of the League of Nations that seem to have been fairly successful. I know that it's really correct to say that the League did very little or didn't have the power to stop German militarism or Japanese expansion in Asia, to stop the Italian invasion of Ethiopia, that in many ways the League failed miserably.
But
in preventing war.
The Japanese left the League. Did the Italians leave
the Italians ultimately left, as did the Germans.
Oh, what years were those?
Well, the Germans left. The most important sort of member country to leave was Germany, who left in September of 1933.
Oh.
And they left. No, they, excuse me, they joined in 1933.
Oh.
And then they left.
Weren't they members of the League with the Weimar Republic?
Right. No, they left in 1933. That's right.
Right.
So, and the withdrawal of Germany was in part because the League of Nations said to Germany, you, on the basis of a complaint made by a German Jew that his minority rights were being violated, the League of Nations said, you can't violate minority rights. And so,
due to the peace treaty of Lausanne, which didn't concern them?
For them, the Treaty of Versailles.
For them, the Treaty of Versailles.
And also because they were a member state of the League of Nations. And so Hitler said, well, you know, okay, you can't interfere with our national sovereignty. We're out of here. And so as member states started to leave, the moral authority and also the actual authority of the League began to dissipate.
Well, if a primary European power leaves and the Americans never joined, it doesn't leave much, does
it? Nope. And so that's the League's power really begins to decline precipitously in 1933 onwards. And, certainly by 1938, 39, when it expels the Soviet Union for...
Oh, I didn't know that. Tell us about that.
Well, the Soviet Union...
Due to the war in Finland?
Exactly.
Oh.
Yeah. The Soviet Union joined, I think, in 1934, and then it left in 1939, or it was forced out in 1939.
Didn't know that.
Yeah. So it's... The League did do some very important and interesting things that created the basis for...
The United Nations.
Well, the United Nations, but also many of the programs the League continued into the United Nations period.
This and what are they?
The International Labor Office, the World Court, and also just the work it did...
Is that the court in Hague, or is that...
Yep, exactly. Okay. So, but also I think the League of Nations really created... the way that the international community, for better or for worse, tries to manage refugee crisis. Mm. And that's because it had one of the first big important jobs of the League was trying to deal with the refugee crises of the First World War, including the displacement of lots of Russians, but also lots of Armenians and Greeks and Turks. Armenians as a consequence of the genocide, and then Greeks and Turks as a consequence of the exchange of populations.
You might want to explain that, but that's interesting. What you're talking about is what we wanted to go. League of Nations lessons for today's UN. That's what you're talking about. The institutions that we got. Can you leave the UN now?
Well, I mean, it's voluntary membership, and no one's. I mean,
has anybody ever left?
People have withdrawn. I mean, groups have. But it's very rare. I mean, for example, I think there were.
It gives them a forum. Why should they leave?
Right. I mean, there were attempts in the 70s to expel South Africa from the League of Nations.
Okay.
And also there's been attempts to expel Israel from the League of Nations. Good. And there was a very viable American movement for the United States to...
Withdraw,
right? But that's often associated with sort of far right-wing crackpots and so on now. I think the UN has been around for such a long period of time now. Membership is sort of just what you do as a state. It's very natural.
So the fact of the matter is the League was around from 1922 to essential effectivity till 1933, actually, when the Soviet Union comes and Germany leaves. After that 11 years, it's treading water.
Right, but it disappears... It only disappears really when it becomes the UN. In fact, the UN buys up, the property of the League of Nations gets transferred to the UN.
In Switzerland.
Well, right. For example, the World Health Organization and the arms control, UN arms control, and even the UN archive are in
Geneva. Those arms control issues in the 20s, like the Kellogg Peace Treaty all those were part of League of Nations.
A lot of them were attempts to limit the size of navies and so on.
Right.
But these were were very difficult, A, to enforce, and B.
But were they under the auspices of the League?
Often they were negotiated under the auspices of the League.
That's what I didn't know.
Yeah. So you, but There was the League Disarmament Commission. There was also, though, other things which we have today which come from the League, including the League's health organization, which is now the WHO.
How about the human rights issues of today?
Well, that's the interesting thing. In many ways, human rights issues at the League centered on the rights of minorities. And it wasn't clear if the League was really about human rights or minority rights, protecting the rights of minorities within populations, within national populations, big national populations. And that's very different about the modern UN, which is the modern UN focuses more on human rights and less on group rights or minority rights. That's also, I think, in many ways a recognition that the League's original focus on minority rights was a bit of a failure. But on the other hand, I think that the idea of the refugee and how the refugee is the responsibility of the international community is a very important innovation, which we can trace to the League of Nations. The creation of a League of Nations-based passport system for refugees, the so-called Nansen passport, extremely important, and it resembles the UN's use of travel documents and so on for various refugee populations.
Was that Fridtjof Nansen alive in 1922 when all this was?
Oh yeah, Fridtjof Nansen was hired by the League. You know, he was this great Arctic explorer, and
he was Norwegian,
wasn't he? Right. Yeah. And so they hired him. The League hired him to try to figure out how to repatriate Russian prisoners of war. And it was while doing that he began to understand that the refugee problem was incredible and immense. And so he moved on from just working with Russians to then working with Armenians. And the only drawback is that in order for you to be considered a refugee by the United Nations, or by the League of Nations, the League of Nations had to issue a mandate that you were a refugee. So the League of Nations issued mandates for Russians and for Armenians and Greeks and Turks and Assyrians, but, for example, an attempt to try to keep Germany in the League would not recognize Jews as refugees. So interesting sorts of dilemmas
in terms of finances, did the countries have to pay some sort of quota to be in the
middle? Well, they were supposed
to make
contributions.
Where did they get their money from?
They were supposed to make contributions.
In today's UN, is the United States up to snuff on that?
I'm trying to remember. I mean, one of the things that Barack Obama wanted to do was make sure we paid up.
The Republicans weren't too anxious of paying.
That was a big thing under Bill Clinton, I remember. The management of the League, wasn't cheap, but it wasn't that expensive. I mean, it wasn't like the contemporary UN, which has a much larger bureaucracy and even even peacekeeping forces and so on.
Well, it's most people don't know much about the League and the relationship of the First World War peace treaties that ended that brought things to a head. I was going to ask you about the Dodge refugee things and the things that Herbert Hoover did before the end of the war, Is there some connection? I remember that Near East Relief had a lot to do with not only helping Armenian refugees from the Armenian Genocide, which we haven't covered yet this year. Certainly, that's how Hoover became a well-known and famous individual.
Hoover headed what was called the American American Relief Expedition, or sort of war relief.
Yeah.
And it was official. It was an official body of the United States government. It was supposed to first help Belgium, but then eventually spread over all of continental Europe into Russia.
Right.
And then there was Near East Relief, which was what we would call now today a non-governmental organization.
Was this Dodge in any way related to the famous Dodge family here?
Not that Dodge family.
I see.
Bayard Dodge and Cleveland Dodge.
I see.
Which were connected with the American University in Beirut, but also Cleveland Dodge was a great sort of like an Andrew Carnegie or a John D. Rockefeller figure. He was a great one of these great robber barons of the latter part of the 19th century.
We have about exactly 2 minutes left, and how would you like to wrap all this up in 2 minutes and tell us what you think?
Sure. I think that there's a very important lesson here, which was that one of the reasons why the League of Nations failed was that the United States didn't participate with it. And it's a good lesson to learn, which is that when the United States withdraws itself from international cooperation and working towards peace through diplomacy and international bodies, that bad things happen in the world. And that the real lesson to learn here is to make sure that the United States is at the forefront of promoting its values and ideals within an international community.
Does the U.S. Institute of Peace have a large role to play in it that you're
not really?
Not really.
But, you know, peace is always usually a good thing.
Why don't you tell us about, in the last minute, we have a minute, what the U.S. Institute of Peace is all about?
Well, it tries to build capacity for peacemaking around the world. And so one of the things, for example, it hosted the Iraq Study Group for the Iraq Study Group report. But the Institute of Peace also goes to other parts of the world and works with local people in terms of how to do peace and reconciliation projects, how to negotiate treaties and agreements, and generally trying to make sure that discussions of peace and reconciliation are on the table in conflict.
Keith, let me take this minute to thank you very much.
Sure.
And, you know, you have so much, your expertise about Islam is something we're gonna do in the future. The historian, associate professor of modern Islam, human rights and peace, and religious studies programs are it's another topic we're going to do. We're going to contact you again, and I hope you enjoyed our program today.
Sure.
And thank you very much.
Thank you, Ned.